This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. In 1897, a society matron named Cornelia Martin threw a lavish ball at the Waldorf Hotel in New York. The creme de la creme of society showed up, including John Jacob Astor and J.P. Morgan, along with women decked out in hundreds of thousands of dollars in glittering jewels. But as Chrystia Freeland writes in her new book, the opulence of that Gilded Age ball turned out to be, well, a little bit over the top, even for a city that was pretty used to opulence. And the Martins soon felt they had to leave the country, seeking sanctuary in their English house and their rented 65,000-acre estate in Scotland. And now Freeland argues we are living through the rise of another Gilded Age, one that might be a little better hidden from us, but that represents a sort of abundance that most of us can't quite wrap our arms around. Chrystia Freeland is the digital editor at Thomson Reuters and author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. Chrystia Freeland, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be with you.
So I'm just going to start with a statistic that is kind of amazing. In the 1970s, the top 1% of people in America had about 10% of the national income. Now, the top 1% has 30% of the national income. 1970 wasn't so long ago. What happened?
Well, you've had this huge, huge rise in income inequality, as those numbers show. I mean, to me, an even more striking number is the top 0.1%, so the top 10% of the 1%, is now close to 8% of the national income. So think about that for a minute. The top 10% of the 1% is now almost at the level where the entire 1% was in the 70s. So there has been this tremendous surge in income inequality, with a particular surge at the very, very top of the income distribution. This is particularly acute in the United States, but it is a global phenomenon. It's happening in communist China. It's happening to a lesser degree, but still happening in Scandinavia, in Canada. This is something we're seeing all over the world. Warren Buffett pointed it out this week. He pointed out that when you look at the top 400 richest Americans and compare their wealth today with their wealth 1992, that's not so long ago at all, it has more than quintupled, gone up more than five times. That has not happened to the average middle class family. In fact, all of this has been happening at the same time that middle class incomes, again, particularly in the U.S., have been stagnating. At least for the past decade, the middle class has been treading water.
So let me actually insert here a clip from Warren Buffett just recently talking to Jon Stewart about the growing wealth of those, as you said, at the very top.
Well, if they make over a million, I say on the amount over a million, they ought to pay at least 30%. And then over 10 million, they ought to pay 35%. Most of the people, in fact, virtually all of the people in my office, 20 or so people, between payroll and income taxes pay more than 30%. And a number of the extremely wealthy people pay less than 15%, and some pay less than 10%.
Now, this is because of capital gains and the Cayman Islands,
the whole
and bags that are kept dangling.
You're getting warm. 20 years ago, the Forbes 400 had an aggregate wealth of $300 billion. Now it's more than quintuple. That has not happened with the middle class.
Well, also, productivity of workers has, I think, doubled, yet
sure.
Median income has stayed stagnant.
Yeah.
Very slow.
And I don't think the American public really understands that. It kind of snuck up on them. The tax rate, I mean, you've got of the 400 highest incomes in the United States in 2009, the most recent years we have figures for, a quarter of the people paid taxes at a rate less than 15%. The payroll tax was 15.3% in that year.
And
six of them paid nothing at all. I mean, they were part of they were part of the 47%. I mean, these people were big time moochers.
Chrystia Freeland, I see you nodding there. I mean, like he said, there's been this huge separation. And interestingly, as the separation has gone on, the tax burden on people at the very, very top who would seem to have the money to spare to pay taxes most of all has gotten less and less. What's happened there policy-wise?
So I think two things are going on. Part of what's happening is very powerful, and I would actually say largely benign, economic trends. The technology revolution, I would say, above all, also globalization. And it's pretty obvious, right? We see how our world, how the economy is being transformed in a very disruptive, I think ultimately very positive, and very fast way. And that is this sort of, you know, it's this economic coin, which on the one hand is facilitating the creation of these huge fortunes very fast at the very top. But those same economic processes are also hollowing out the middle class. They mean that a factory can operate with many fewer workers. They mean that jobs that used to need to be done in the United States can be outsourced to workers who operate, who are paid much less. They mean that some jobs no longer exist. I mean, when's the last time you talked to an actual human travel agent?
Yeah, so, or went to a bank teller.
Right, yeah. And those were actually, you know, middle class, white collar jobs. Right. So part of it is these economic forces. But you and Warren Buffett, that's a nice category to be put in,
it
right?
is.
Are absolutely right to point to policy too. And policy, government policy can either lean into these trends, can either intensify them, or it can soften them. So, and the perverse thing, particularly in the United States, and here the U.S. is somewhat of an outlier compared to other Western developed economies. In America, even as these trends have been happening with huge intensity, the government has been pulling back, has actually been doing less to soften the blow for the middle class and actually lessening the burden on the people at the very top at precisely the moment when, you know, they could maybe carry a little more of the load.
You point to the 70s and 80s as sort of the time when this kind of shifted. And, I mean, you mentioned the president, Ronald Reagan, lowered rates, I think, from a high rate of 70% to 28% on the people at the very top. That is a huge shift in the burden. And is that the time when you think a lot of this stuff started to come together to create these plutocrats at the top?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of policy, there was this sort of neoliberal moment in the world. Reagan in the U.S., Margaret Thatcher in the U.K., not incidentally the collapse of communism, right? The invalidation of any real meaningful systemic alternative to free market capitalism. And so you had around the world really this sense that the state needed to pull back, that you needed to privatize, that you needed to deregulate. The deregulation of Wall Street is a very big part of this story. And that helped to drive these economic transformations. Globalization was really facilitated by this, but it also happened to intensify the distributional impact of what was a very profound economic change.
Now, would you say that the people in the top 1%, the top 10th of 1%, whatever the group is, are actively involved now in lobbying the government to make sure that their taxes don't go up or their deductions don't disappear? Is that something that's important to them, or is that just incidentally happened to them?
No, I don't think that these things happen by accident. I mean, I think that there are really two parts of it. You know, there are the very specific provisions which business is very good at lobbying for. And frankly, it's the job of business. It's the job of everyone in society to engage with politics and to lobby legally as intensively as you can for the provisions that suit your interest. There is also, though, I think, a bigger ideological piece to what has been going on. And for a really long time, really since the 70s, I think that there has been, since the late 70s, early 80s, there has been this wider view, which actually was reflected in an earlier interview I heard about Mitt Romney, that what business was seeking, and not just business, but what the top 1% or the 0.1%, the plutocrats, what they were arguing for, the policies they were advocating, were not about selfish self-interest. They were the best policies to serve the common good. And you heard that from Mitt Romney in that call he had with his donors.
Right. Where the idea of the job creators, the creators and then the takers.
Right, where he said, you know, Barack Obama is giving things to these interest groups. I wasn't playing that game. I was advocating things which served the common good. And that is why I think that right now you are hearing from the super rich, from the plutocrats, you know, such a shriek of pain and a real sense. This is something that was a real surprise for me when I was doing the reporting for my book, a real sense of victimization. And that was a shock to me because actually, if you look at the data does not suggest this is a victimized group, including under Obama. This is a group that is doing probably better economically than an elite has ever done in human history, and yet they feel victimized. And I think that that is because people, including the reelected president, have started to challenge this notion that what is good for the very, very top in this moment in economic history is inevitably good for the people in the middle. That's a very threatening idea.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because one of Warren Buffett's points is that it's not even equal. I mean, that he pays much less, and he always does this. He does this little straw poll in his office, and everybody in his office every year will calculate what their tax rate is. And almost every year, he has the lowest tax rate and is, of course, by far the richest person in his office, I think a fortune of between $40 and $50 billion. So it's not even that that people making $150,000 a year and people making $150 million a year are paying the same percentage in taxes. Often the people making $150 million a year are paying a lesser percentage. When you talk to people at the very top about that, what do they make of that? Do they think that seems fair, not fair?
So there are different levels of explanation of this.
Mm-hmm.
And there is certainly, you know, the Warren Buffett group. But Buffett is not the only sort of liberal plutocrat who believes that he and people in his class should be paying taxes at a higher rate. Having said that, there is also a very strong conviction, and I think this has been expressed most articulately recently in a book by Ed Conard, formerly of Bain Capital, who actually argued that it is a good thing for people at the top to pay lower taxes and the middle class to pay higher taxes because people at the top, by definition, are the best allocators of capital in society, right? That's how they got rich. So you got rich by making wise investments, and so a wise society gives you more money, and those schmucks in the middle who aren't as good investors as you, otherwise they would be as rich as you are, should have less money in their hands because for the common good, for economic growth, it's better for the best allocators of capital to have the most money. And I heard quite a few people say that. I talked to a guy called Foster Freese, who was
Rick Santorum
backer. And I talked to him about taxes. And in his first response, you know, when I said, well, you know, maybe the rich should pay higher taxes, his first reaction was to introduce me to this concept of the self-tax. And he said, you know, we non-rich people don't realize how much rich people self-tax, how much they pay to the charities of their choice. And he said, that's much better than paying the money to the government because it's more fun. You get to choose what you're going to spend your money on. But then he sort of really got going, and he argued that actually someone like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, they shouldn't pay taxes at all. In fact, he said the government should pay them money. And his argument was, as he put it, and this is sort of a direct quote, he said, I've never seen a poor person create jobs. Hmm. Bill Gates does create jobs. So he should be the guy who has the money.
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH, and we're talking to Chrystia Freeland, author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. And you brought up a really interesting point, which is this question of whether, I wonder if it's widespread amongst, let's say, the top 10th of a percent, that the people at the top are there because they deserve to be. The sort of makers and the takers argument, that the people at the top are the makers and everybody else benefits from their largesse. Would you say people generally feel like they're up there because that merit? I mean, that's where they deserve to be.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. And in a way, it is, I think, the paradoxical consequence of meritocracy or meritocracy of past decades. Emmanuel Saez, who is a Berkeley economist, who is one of the leading students of income inequality and especially the 1%, and he is no diehard conservative at all. But he has described today's super elite as the working rich compared to elites of the past. This is largely not inherited money, and most of the a lot of the income, especially compared to previous elites, comes from actual work. Now, I'm not saying these are people, you know, who came up from the gutter and pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. Mitt Romney is maybe a good example. So if you want to be a plutocrat, it is wise to choose affluent parents. Having said that, you know, Bain Capital, he didn't inherit. He did, you know, as the meme goes, he built it himself. And you may think, I think I probably imagined that having done it yourself and that connection, that sort of, you know, not humble but more modest background might give you a closer connection with the middle class, with everybody else. In a lot of cases, I think it actually has a distancing effect and creates this sense of, I did it myself, you didn't do it, and, you know, therefore this distribution is fair in some sense. The most clear expression of this I heard from one of the Russian oligarchs. You can always rely on the Russians to be very direct. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who at the time was the richest man in Russia. And I was asking him about this, and he said, if a man is not an oligarch, something is not right with him. We all had the same chances. Some of us did it. Some of us didn't. There you go.
Interesting. No, you know, you said a lot of this is self-made money. I mean, certainly to some degree, there's some inherited money. And obviously, as time goes on, as Mitt Romney's children inherit what he made and as other people's children inherit what they made, that's going to be less and less true. And in fact, you have a quote, which I'm going to read from Holly Peterson, the daughter of Pete Peterson, a billionaire. And she says, here's the problems of the super rich. There's so much money on the Upper East Side right now. A lot of people under 40 are making like $20 million or $30 million a year in these hedge funds, and they don't know what to do with it. And she describes this conversation at a dinner party. They started saying, if you're going to buy all this stuff, life starts getting really expensive. If you're going to do the net jets thing, and if you're going to have four houses and you're going to run the four houses, it's like you start spending some money.
Yeah, exactly. And Holly, you know, in that conversation, Holly reported someone saying to her, and she said she was shocked by this, you know, 20 is only 10 after taxes.
Right.
I spoke to another a Wall Street hedge fund guy who had been asked to offer some financial advice to mutual friends. And they were retired in their late 60s, early 70s. Both of them had been doctors, very eminent careers. And he said to me with absolute sincerity and concern about them, he said, I was really worried about them. They only had investable assets of $10 million. And I'm just really worried about how they're going to manage in their retirement. He thought it was just shocking that people who had worked so hard would be left in their late 60s and early 70s with just $10 million.
Were there examples of the kinds of things that people spent their money on that really surprised you as you were doing the research for plutocrats?
Actually, not.
No.
And I think that that is, you know, one of the conceptions that I think we have and something that sort of we like to think about is conspicuous consumption and, you know, things like that Bradley Martin ball and so on. But actually what I was struck by is the extent to which for today's plutocracy, super consumption, conspicuous consumption is not really the greatest status symbol. I mean, sure, it's nice to have a private jet and a beautiful home and many are great art collectors, but where the action really is in thought leadership. It is in the greatest status symbol is in having your own think tank, which you use to have an active and creative impact on public policy. We were just talking about Holly Peterson, her father, Pete Peterson, right? Second incarnation as the great deficit hawk. Bill Gates, second incarnation as the guy who is going to solve Africa's health problems. George Soros, original stateless statesman. And this is really where you see the spending of money that I think among the plutocrats themselves has the highest value.
Now, but does out of these think tanks ever come papers or discussions about, wow, the top 0.1% seem to be really getting a lot of money here? Certainly, like you said, the Concord Coalition definitely into paying down the debt. But I wonder, what is their position on the very richest people and whether they should pay payroll tax for all their income, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I think it's an excellent point. And I think, you know, one of the phenomena that we're seeing is something that a European economist called Willem Buiter has called cognitive capture. And cognitive capture, as he has described it, is, you know, he says the super rich, in this case, he was particularly talking about Wall Street and the City of London, it's not that they bribe people. You know, it's not that they're bribing the regulators and the legislators and the academics and the journalists. But what happens is they create this sort of ecosystem of ideas and partly of jobs. And you see the intellectual capture where the people who aren't plutocrats, the people who are creating the ideas and the laws that govern them, start seeing the world from the point of view of the plutocrats. And this sort of universe of aspiring towards thought leadership tends to feed into that. Again, I don't think it's intentional, but I think it's one of the reasons why you do have a lot of the discourse in the world, again, until quite recently, I think maybe it's shifting a little bit, be from a very sort of plutocratocentric point of view. If I can give you one quick example, something that struck me so much when I went back and looked at it to write this book was a report that Mike Bloomberg and Chuck Schumer, okay, very centrist people, jointly commissioned from McKinsey. In 2007, January 2007.
And I should say, Mike Bloomberg, mayor of New York, Chuck Schumer, senator from New York.
Right, exactly. This is on the eve of the financial crisis, okay? And this report was about what are New York's pressing economic problems. And their core conclusion was the big threat New York faces is it could be overtaken by London as a global financial center. And the two big problems with policy were not enough credit derivatives and not enough innovation in credit derivatives. Just think about that. Not enough credit derivatives. Their key recommendation, allow more credit derivative innovation in New York. And their second key recommendation was capital requirements are far too tough on the banks and are constraining economic activity. So, like, wow. That's cognitive capture big time.
Well, and that's the question, too, about living in the bubble. You know, you said it's maybe not so much about conspicuous consumption, but if you're flying on net jets and you're drinking bottled water and and actually Michael Sandel from Harvard has recently written a book about this, even if you're not wearing $250,000 in diamonds, you may still be living a life that is so substantially apart from the normal experience of people, regular people, that you don't really, you lose touch with how they live. And you actually have a great line from somebody who works at the White House, you don't name them, but a staffer who used to make a ton of money in the private sector. And he says, you know, look, when I go to meetings in Asia, they expect me to fly like a regular commercial. Well, I don't feel like I can do my job well, you know, in that situation because he's not used to flying commercial. Like he wants to fly first class or better.
Even first class is slumming it,
exactly.
Right? You should have your private jet.
That's right.
No, seriously. No. That's exactly right. And you know, one of the things which is sort of a core thesis of my book and an argument is in all sorts of cultural and social ways, the plutocrats are increasingly living in a world apart from everybody else. And, you know, they have more in common with one another, no matter which country they come from, than they do with the middle classes back home. They all have they have multiple houses, generally in the same global cities. They go to the same global events. You know, they go to Davos in January, St. Bart's in December, Aspen in July. They see each other on that circuit. They meet each other at these same conferences. They even, in terms of their personal lives, lead a very different life from the middle class. We're seeing in the middle class women catching up with men, a much more egalitarian way of living, that the two-income family is becoming the norm. Within the plutocracy, it's pure patriarchy. So even in terms of their family arrangements, they live very differently from the rest of us. And I do think that distance makes it harder to really perceive what is happening to everybody else, and it makes it harder to have sympathy. So one of the things I was really struck by is clearly part of what we're seeing is the consequence of globalization. And there are some great things that are happening because of globalization, notably the rise of people into the middle class in places like India and China. And what one of these plutocrats said to me, and he said it's sort of like it wasn't him, it was like his friend. It was someone on his investment committee. He said someone on his investment committee had said, why is this a problem? If three or four people rise into the middle class in India or China and one person drops out of the middle class in the United States, isn't that a good trade? And, you know, from some people's perspective, it might be. But I think if you were at the middle class, probably not neighbor, but person living in the same state as that guy in America, and this is an American money manager, you might have some questions in your mind.
Yeah, they had, like you said, it's interesting. There is this sort of international elite, and they cross borders without any trouble. I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH Boston Public Radio, and we're talking to Chrystia Freeland, author of Plutocrats: The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. And I want to get to how this might, how we might be able to undo potentially some of this plutocracy. But first, since we're sitting here in Boston, let's talk a little bit about the superstar effect, which I thought was so interesting. And I'll start with one example, which is academics. And you say, this is a quote from the book, academics in fields that the plutocracy values can multiply their salaries by working as consultants and speakers to super elite audiences, often in the emerging markets. As Neil Ferguson, who's at Harvard, told me during a whirlwind weekend when he had given a speech to a private equity conference hosted by a Turkish plutocrat in Istanbul, followed by a speech in Yalta for a Ukrainian plutocrat, Viktor Pinchuk, the roads out of Cambridge, Massachusetts get jammed on Thursday afternoons as Harvard Business School professors rush to the airport to get to their international speaking gigs. So the plutocracy spills over to other areas of life.
Right. I mean, the intellectuals become the courtiers, the court jesters, the entertainment, whatever you want to call them, for the plutocrats. And that's a pretty good gig, probably a way to make more money than your day job. You know, academia, journalism, the other places where intellectuals have typically been employed are places that are under a lot of strain. So, you know, these speaking gigs are definitely have a really nice multiplier effect. And again, you know, I don't want to in any way suggest any kind of corruption or anything, but this is where I think you start to see that cognitive capture that Boyder talks about sort of starting to take effect, you know, and I think, you know, if you are writing a book, do you maybe think, let's imagine who will invite me and pay me a significant amount of money to give a talk based on this book? And I'll tell you what, it's probably not going to be your middle class PTA.
Right, right. You have to think about your audience. And there's that elite of superstars in academia, too. You also talk about in the 1980s, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was then at Disney, basically writing a memo saying, I'm really worried about superstars in the movie industry. Of course, that ended up happening to him as a CEO. I mean, the CEOs became the superstars.
Right, right. The CEOs decided that turned out to benefit from the same effect. I mean, that Katzenberg memo is truly hilarious. It's readily available online or in my book. I urge everyone to read it. And he has some great lines. Like he says, let's not hire the established stars. Let's hang out outside the exits of the Betty Ford Clinic, you know, and pick up the faded ones because we can, you know, they can do great work. We don't have to pay them so much. An interesting thing that did happen is managers, or at least a certain class of managers, have found a way to package themselves as superstars and get paid accordingly. And that's actually, we are in Boston. That is partly thanks to thinking by the business school professoriate that began to argue again, and the timing is interesting. In the 60s, in the 70s, there was some academic work that was arguing that American CEOs were underpaid, and you had to pay them more to have real incentives to get them to really work hard. And that's what has happened. Now, there is, I think, a real problem there, which is sort of the agency problem, that we think of corporate America as being this sort of arch capitalist environment. But actually, if you look at some of America's biggest companies, the shareholding is so widely dispersed that in a way, the better comparison might be with a Yugoslav workers' collective, where, you know, the top workers are really running the company without very much true ownership oversight and perhaps running it in their own self-interest.
But the argument of the CEOs is, I mean, I'm making 50 times what the janitor's making because I'm worth it.
It's not 50 times.
Okay.
It's like 350, 400 times. That's where there's a gap. And yes, that is the argument. And, you know, globalization and the technology revolution have again had an impact, because if your company is 5, 10, 20 times as big, then surely you, the CEO, should be paid accordingly. Because, you know, even if you are, let's say, just 1% better than the next possible CEO, 1% across a company that has $3 or $4 billion worth of revenue, that's a lot. And even if you're paying your CEO $5 or $10 million, hey, if he gives you 1% better performance, it's a great deal.
But the idea of what people deserve and that gap between the people at the top of a company and the people at the bottom has really grown. I remember years ago going on a tour of Ben & Jerry's, which has always been a kind of company that valued social equity, in Vermont. And they said that when they started out, they pledged the CEO was never going to make more than 7 times more what the lowest paid worker made. But you've seen since the 1950s, since the 1970s, this gap between what the janitor makes and what the guy in the corner office makes just explode.
Absolutely. And again, you know, within corporate America, I think you can argue whether shareholders are getting real value out of paying their CEOs as much as they are paying them. But more broadly, you know, this is the impact of the superstar economy and the impact of those economic forces that are hollowing out the middle class and allowing those at the very, very top to rise. You know, the truth is there is tremendous downward pressure on wages for the middle class. And actually the janitor, and, you know, with due respect to janitors who are listening to this, who will probably disagree with me, but probably doesn't feel this way. But actually, if you look at the income distribution numbers, people doing jobs like being a janitor, relatively speaking, relative to everybody else and relative to history, haven't done so badly, because they are at least doing a hands-on job that can't be done by a machine or done by somebody in China.
Right.
The people who are really getting hammered relative to where they were, say, in the 70s or in the 80s, are people who are doing jobs that can be done by machines, you know, the travel agents, the secretaries, or people who are doing jobs that can be outsourced. That's where you're seeing just a tremendous squeeze. And, you know, a great example actually is Detroit and the auto bailout. In many respects, I think that this has turned out to be one of the big achievements of the first Obama administration. It worked, it saved some companies, and it saved a lot of jobs. But if you sort of look under the hood, as it were, at the jobs that were saved, the new workers who are being hired there are being hired at much, much, much lower wages than the legacy workers, at $13, $14, $15 an hour. And what we're seeing, I think, is not so much structural unemployment as structural working poor, people who have what we would have considered a generation ago to be a good, solid middle-class job. You still have that job. You're still working the hours, but actually you're pretty poor.
Yeah, yeah. And very often you're competing with somebody in Bangladesh who can do the job for pennies on the dollar.
Well, people, you know, those same cars can be made by a Mexican worker who earns $7, does just as good work, by a worker in China who earns maybe $1 or $2 an hour.
Right. You know, so, okay, so now let's talk about what the response of the vast American public is here. And you have a really interesting anecdote in your book that comes from Michael Norton of Harvard Business School and Duke's Danny Ariely. And what they do is they show people the wealth distribution in the U.S. and show them that the top 20% of people own 84% of the total wealth. They also show them the distribution in Sweden, where the top 20% of people own 36% of the money. 92% of Americans that they asked said, yeah, I like the Sweden model better. And then when they ask them, okay, well, what's the optimal amount that people should own? They say, well, they go for even more equality than Sweden. They say, well, I think maybe the top 20% should own 32% of the money. Okay, so how do you then reconcile that with a country in which, honestly, 20% own 84% of the money? Where are we going? What is the population's response to the world of plutocrats?
Well, I thought Warren Buffett put it really well in that clip that you played, where he said that he thinks this has snuck up on people. I think that's absolutely right. Some of the time when I've been talking with people about my book, people have said, oh, come on, why are you writing about this? Surely the rich have always been with us. At which point I jump up and down with a red face and say, no, it's really different this time. So I think that people don't fully appreciate it, although the gap is becoming so great that even intuitively we're starting to see it. One reason people haven't appreciated is actually because of cheap consumer credit. You know, a very powerful and, to my mind, compelling theory about one of the reasons we had the credit bubble and the financial crisis is in the United States, because there was this sort of ideological allergy to higher taxes and greater redistribution, a response to rising income inequality was to give this sort of stagnating middle class very easy access to cheap consumer credit. And so over the past decade, up to the financial crisis, people didn't feel they were getting poorer because they were borrowing lots of money. They were borrowing money on their credit cards. They were taking out home equity loans. So I think that was very important. And frankly, I do think ideology plays a role. You know, I think the cries that we heard during the election campaign of class war, and those were sort of leveled at the president in response to, you know, what seemed to me to be relatively mild populist rhetoric. There was populism there for sure. You know, millionaires and billionaires have to pay their fair share. But, you know, this was hardly Lenin on the barricades. And that immediately elicited an accusation of class war. And what was interesting was the assumption, I would say even the certainty, that as soon as you slapped a label of class war on that way of talking about the economy, that would invalidate it. That you sort of, I would say in America until quite recently, talking about distribution has been considered to be rude, wrong, immoral.
Anti-capitalist.
And just you're not a good person. Right. That the way you should be talking about it is focusing on growing the pie for everyone. That was the good, wholesome way to discuss the economy. That was what was healthy. That was sort of the correct centrist approach. And meanwhile, you know, the division of the pie was becoming more and more extreme, so extreme actually. And this, I think, is sort of the turning point. America, over the past decade, has reached the point where even as the economy grew, the middle class stayed in the same place or even lost ground. That is, you know, the ultimate indictment of trickle down right now isn't working.
So do you think that means policies are actually going to change for people at the top, that they are going to start paying more in taxes, that there may be a little bit more leveling out?
Well, I think that there is more of a push in that direction and more real political energy in that direction than we have seen for a generation. One counterbalancing factor, and this is such an important issue and so hard to tackle, is this plutocracy is global. And so actually levying taxes on a global plutocrat is really, really hard to do.
So if you're in the U.S. government, are you worried then that, you know, goodbye, people, they might be in Monaco next month? I mean, that really they will just take their bags and just go to the place that is most hospitable to them tax-wise.
I think that that is a very real danger. And by the way, you don't have to move. Your money can move for you.
Good point.
And it's true, we're seeing it with companies. I mean, one of the really hot issues in Europe right now is European countries are realizing that there are all of these big U.S.-based multinationals who do a lot of activity in Europe and pay almost no taxes.
I've been speaking with Chrystia Freeland, the digital editor at Thomson Reuters and author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. Chrystia Freeland, a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I loved it.
And here's Edgar B. Herwick. I hear the music.
Music.
Coming up.
Holiday time. It's sunny out there, but it's brisk. It's going to be nice and cold tonight, which is good weather for the official tree lighting, the Christmas tree lighting of Boston. Do you know where our tree came from, Kara?
I do, Edgar.
Yes.
Partially because we talked before the show.
It's true. We did. So it comes from Nova Scotia.
And I'm a big
a really
fan
good
of Canada.
Why? And yeah. It's an interesting story, even if you already know it, it's interesting to hear again. So we'll hear from the Deputy Premier of Nova Scotia about why Nova Scotia gives us a Christmas tree every year.
Sounds great. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Edgar B. Herwick III. This is Boston Public Radio. And now, a quick news update.
Good afternoon from the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston. I'm Christina Quinn with an update. Two trolleys have collided at the Boylston T station today. The MBTA tells us that one subway trolley bumped into the back of another trolley right before noon. Six passengers have been transported to the hospital, but the fire department says no serious injuries have been reported. T spokesman Joe Passacero says it was a low-impact collision and that there was no derailment, but it is unclear as to why the moving trolley got so close to the stationary trolley.
Well, there'll be a thorough investigation into how this occurred, obviously. And then we also want to, once the measurements have been taken and all the accident reconstruction work is done, we'll move these trolleys out of the way.
Passacero says there will be delays this afternoon, but he expects regular Green Line service to resume before the afternoon commute. I'm Christina Quinn. For more news, visit WGBHnews.org. And now back to Boston Public Radio.